The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
The land who rules over you simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, so I'm delighted to be joined by my most very good friend, Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I am with you, yes. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And what Peter has for us today is a presentation entitled "The Real Story Behind the Massacres in Syria." So where would you like to start us off with this very timely topic, Peter?
Thank you, Andrew. Well, you know, Damascus is known as the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. And of course, the biblical city, we know that Damascus is the destination that Saul of Tarsus was heading towards when he encountered Christ on the road to Damascus and was converted. We also know that Antioch, which is also in Syria, was the first place where believers were called Christians. We learn the book of Acts. So Damascus, Antioch, these are biblical sites in the book of Acts. And Syria is a very important Arab country. It's the largest of the Arab countries in the Middle East that emerged from the Ottoman Turkish Empire. And it's important for us to know what's going on there, because it's just another example of a stable country betrayed, a prosperous, self-sufficient country betrayed, devastated, destroyed, a trail of betrayal left behind us. And I know exactly what our good friend Stephen Mitford Goodson would say. Syria is one of the last countries in the world that didn't have a Rothschild-controlled bank built on usury. And so, you know, what a coincidence. As Stephen Mitford Goodson said in his book, A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind, you've got the amazing coincidence that all the targets of the wars in the 20th century were countries that didn't have a Rothschild-controlled bank built on usury. And that would include Germany in 1930s and 40s, and Japan in 1930s and 40s, Italy in the 30s and 40s, of course. And most recently, we've seen that countries like Iraq, Libya, and Syria most lately didn't have a Rothschild-controlled bank. So isn't that an amazing coincidence? The West targets and bombs countries that don't have a Rothschild-controlled bank built on usury and indebtedness. So that's intriguing. But I think as we've been considering the legacy of Jimmy Carter, how he betrayed the stable Iran of the Shah of Iran into the hands of the Ayatollah Khomeini's crazies, and betrayed Ian Smith's Rhodesia into the hands of the Marxist thugs running Zimbabwe today. This is just another example of the trail of betrayal of stable, peaceful countries that have been destabilized, undermined, and handed over to a bunch of mass murdering terrorists. And who could have anticipated, who would have ever believed it, that these ISIS and Al-Qaeda derivative terrorists murder people? I mean, we've been seeing some horrific, very disturbing images of the widespread massacres of unarmed people, civilians, men, women, children, old people, young people, babies even killed in cold blood, throats cut, people just shot in the head, piles of bodies. This is mass murder on a large and widespread, disgusting scale. And amongst them, Christians being targeted, religious minorities, the Alawites in particular, which is the Alawites are a religious minority in the Middle East, and it happens to be the religious grouping that Assad, Bashar al-Assad came from, and they formed a lot of the support of the country. Interestingly, while Syria was once a very powerful country, and in fact, Damascus was once the capital of the worldwide Islamic Empire under the Umayyad Caliphate. Damascus was the center of Muslim civilization for a time. They later were conquered by the Mamluk Sultanate, and then it was just a provincial capital. Later, they were conquered by the Turks, and they came under centuries of Ottoman rule. Well, at the end of the First World War, as the Turks lost the war, they were carved up by the British. In fact, it was Winston Churchill who actually designed the borders as we find them now in the Middle East. He is Secretary of the Colonies at that time, immediately after the First World War. And he's the one who determined that the Kurds didn't get a country. So Kurdistan should be one of the largest countries around. They've got a massive population. There should be a Kurdistan which would encompass easily 20 million people or more. But Winston Churchill, for whatever reason, included the Kurds in Turkey, a little bit in Syria, quite a lot in Iraq, and a lot also under Iran, and so, or what was then Persia. So the poor Kurds were divided and conquered in that way, and deprived of self-determination and self-rule. So Syria particularly ended up in their particular format, much smaller than they'd been historically. Syria used to be a much bigger country, and the term Syria would normally refer to a larger place. But Syria is quite strategic. It is unusual as a country in the Middle East. It doesn't have any oil. That might be a blessing, actually, but it is still very strategically important. It's a country of fertile plains, high mountains, and deserts, and it's got a very diverse ethnic and religious grouping. Unlike most countries in the Middle East, this is a country with quite a significant amount of minorities. And from our perspective, interesting, there's a large number of Christians in Syria. Over 6% of the population of Syria are Christians, and that's unusual. But the previous government of Bashar Assad actually protected the Christians and religious minorities, even adopted a constitution that recognized religious minorities, religious freedom, women's rights, which is extremely unusual in the Middle East, and freedom of speech and freedom of religion, which made it quite remarkable. But that didn't stop it being targeted by the powers that should not be for destruction. And the USAID invested $15 billion in regime change in Syria, $15 billion, and over the last 10 years. And now they've succeeded. This is the Biden administration's last great achievement, the betrayal of Syria, the handing over this country to a bunch of Marxist Muslim militant thugs. And in fact, it's intriguing that this story of this betrayal goes all the way back to Barack Hussein Obama. So I don't know how many of our listeners have heard of Operation Timber Sycamore, but Operation Timber Sycamore was launched by Barack Hussein Obama. And his vision, his goal was the toppling of the government in Syria. And so they put billions into regime change in Syria in particular. And the first step in this was the Arab Spring. So in 2011, Barack Hussein Obama being president in the United States and Hillary Clinton being a Secretary of State, they particularly put in huge amounts of effort, which was primarily coordinated by USAID. USAID used cell phones and social media to particularly mobilize the spontaneous Arab Spring, which was as spontaneous as a sniper's shot. It was very coordinated. And the US State Department, the CIA, and USAID in particular were key in Operation Timber Sycamore, which was to destroy, overthrow the government of Bashar Assad in Syria. And interestingly enough, one of the first things that Obama did was make sure that this militant radical was released from prison. So we had the man who today is called the president of Syria was released from American prison. America had him captured, along with the ISIS leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He was in the American in detention center, Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And the goal of Operation Timber Sycamore was to launch a massive jihadist army. And these jihadists were drawn from across the globe to ignite a war in Syria, which to date is responsible for at least 600,000 deaths. 600,000 people, more than 500,000, have been killed in the last 10 years. And this has also included a lot of mass beheadings, systematic rapes, crucifixions of Christians, and all manner of hideous atrocities. The key figure to emerge from the conflict was Muhammad al-Jalani, who's a former lieutenant of the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Now, al-Baghdadi was in Guantanamo Bay. Al-Jalani was also locked up by the Americans somewhere, and they were both released at the beginning, as in the first week of Barack Hussein Obama coming to power, and ISIS was launched. Now, ISIS is an American false flag operation. They launched them, and the evidence has come out. It's quite convincing that ISIS was, from the beginning, a Western operation. It was funded and supported by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, United States of America, and by the State of Israel. Intriguingly, 20,000 foreign jihadists got employed in this ISIS movement in Syria, the first goal being to overthrow Assad's secular government that had religious freedom, respect for women, and freedom of religion in Syria. And these thugs in ISIS, they beheaded people, they destroyed churches, they blew up historic monuments. You may recall even the tomb of Daniel, the tomb of Jonah, blown up by ISIS. ISIS was about as radical an Islamic group of thugs as you could ever come across. And the present leader of Syria right now is a former ISIS leader and a former Al-Qaeda leader. But, of course, we see that they're being referred to these days as HRS, HTS. And I think that's just too, it sounds nicer than admitting that they are part of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. But this Project Timber Sycamore basically launched what became known as the Al-Nusra Front, which was, in fact, just Al-Qaeda in Syria. Now, bear in mind that merely 10 years before the so-called Arab Spring, which was a Christian winter, Al-Qaeda terrorists had been responsible, they said, for the passenger jets that were hijacked and crashed into Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the famous 9/11 or September the 11th, 2001 attacks. So interesting that the very people who were being blamed by the U.S. government being responsible for the worst terrorist attack on American soil in history, were then getting huge amounts of funds to launch this new terrorist wing in Syria. And I don't know what the logic was, if there is any logic, but it's also intriguing to notice that Ambassador Stevens, the one who got killed in Benghazi a few years later in 2013, was it, that he was the bag man. He took the first $500 million to help launch ISIS in Syria. And interestingly, that money came from Qatar primarily. I think Saudi Arabia had a hand in it too, possibly Israel, certainly Turkey. The group right now is very much Turkey-backed. Al-Qaeda in Syria, under its various names, became the core of the covert CIA operation to topple the elected government of Bashar al-Assad. And an anti-Syrian American-led alliance supported these forces as they sought to overthrow the legitimate government of Syria. Interesting, by the way, is this al-Jalani himself was designated by the U.S. government an especially dangerous terrorist, and the U.S. government had a $10 million bounty on his head, you know, dead or alive. And that was part of the U.S. Department of Justice Rewards for Justice system. And one of Biden's last acts before his administration was replaced by the present administration was to remove the designation of terrorist from the HTS terrorist group and to remove the $10 million bounty off the head of this al-Jalani, who's now the so-called president or transitional president in Syria. So this is the last actions of the Biden administration. The Biden administration had been part of the covert operation to oust and topple Assad as president of Syria. And of course, at the time, Biden was under Obama. He was the vice president and Obama was the president. So it's Obama who launched this, but it's Biden who finalized this historic option of overthrowing the Syrian government. And this is just the last of a long line of trail of betrayals. I mean, going all the way back to Jimmy Carter and all of his actions to betray the Shah of Iran and Rhodesia. And so the poor Syrians, exhausted by 14 years of Western blockades, debanking, sanctions, and the US military occupation of the north of Syria, which also meant seizure of most of the food and fuel supplies of Syria. And the Syrian forces crumpled and succumbed, and this led to Jalani's rise to power. So the Syrian government, let's remember, was a stable, peaceful, prosperous, constitutional state with religious freedom and with freedom of speech and respect for women's rights and for religious minorities. It was a bastion of Arab nationalism, resistant to the radical jihadism of the left. And while Islam was recognized as the religion of the majority, Syria was a secular state which accorded religious freedom to the 6.3% of the population who were Christians. The Christian minority, the Druze, they all benefited. And Syria is bounded on the north by Turkey, who's played a major role in the betrayal of this country, and on the west, of course, by the Mediterranean Ocean. In the south west, it's bordered by Lebanon and Jordan and Israel, and to the east by Iraq. And so this is a very strategic country, Syria. And interestingly, this al-Jalani quickly shed his jihadist image. He donned a suit and tie, and he's now rebranded himself as President Ahmed al-Sharara. And he claims to be a moderate leader. But his past atrocities, his track record includes thousands of rapes and beheadings by his followers. It remains undeniable. One of his first acts as Syria's new ruler was to appoint Shadi al-Waisi as his justice minister. And we happen to have videos of Shadi al-Waisi caught on video personally ordering the execution of women for so-called adultery, but it wouldn't have qualified as adultery. So Shadi al-Waisi, justice minister of the new interim government, so-called, this terrorist government of Syria. And interestingly, despite this disgusting track record of beheadings, rapes, and mass murder, the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, was happy to give 50 million British pounds to the new terrorist government of Syria for what he called inclusion. Now, I don't know what exactly they thought inclusion meant. The German foreign minister also gave 50 million euro to this new terrorist government. And you will recall that when, at the end of last year, Assad's government was toppled and Assad fled to Moscow for asylum and these terrorists took over Syria, there was dancing, celebrations, applause, and all kinds of claims from all the capitals of Europe about how wonderful this was and, you know, justice, freedom, kumbaya, justice wins again, and at last the brutal authoritarian leader Assad is toppled, and now we've got this day of moderation with this ex-Al-Qaeda terrorist, this ISIS terrorist. And so the question we should have asked, and I was asking already back when they were celebrating the fall of Assad, but surely you can't trust a bunch of terrorists to take over a country. They're not going to be tolerant. They're not going to be peaceful. They will start to murder the Christians, the Shiite, the general Alawite population. It's just totally foreseeable. What we've seen over the last week of mass murder in the north of the country of Syria was totally predictable. The slaughter of the Alawites in Latakia province in the north of Syria is the culmination of a brutal proxy war launched under Barack Obama and finalized by Joe Biden, leading to the collapse of Syria's tolerant secular government and the rise of a radical terrorist regime. We've seen this before. I mean, this is, in fact, exactly what happened to Iran. This is exactly what happened to Rhodesia. And once Syria was admired as the most democratic country in the Arab Middle East, and I know it was renowned amongst Christians ministering in the Middle East as the country with the most freedom and tolerance and protections for Christians in the Middle East. Now, there was a time that you could have said that for Iraq, too, by the way. And I think we need to just remember that before America liberated Iraq from the brutal dictator Saddam Hussein, Christians were 1.6 million in the of the population in Iraq. And Christians were protected. And to the extent that all of the bodyguards, all of the cooks and catering staff of Saddam Hussein were Christians. And the reason's obvious. Christians do not assassinate. Christians can be trusted. And so Saddam Hussein actually cultivated the Christians to such an extent, you can go into the Baptist church in downtown Baghdad today, and you will see a beautiful, massive organ with a brass plaque on it, gift of His Excellency, the President Saddam Hussein. And in fact, many of his bodyguards worshipped in that Baptist church downtown in Baghdad. And so after Iraq was liberated, so-called, in inverted commas, in 2003, the number of Christians in Iraq plummeted. I mean, it's almost genocide, and our friends in Iraq call it genocide because they've gone from 1.6 million Christians in Iraq down to 100,000 Christians in Iraq, if that. And that's probably depleting even now. We've lost 1.5 million Christians out of the Middle East from Iraq as a result of the invasion and toppling of Saddam Hussein's secular government that allowed religious freedom. Because the West seems to think that if you can import Western-style ballot boxes and democracy to the Middle East or anywhere in the world, it's going to be the solution. But that isn't the solution because, plainly, the Middle East is not exactly conducive to democracy, not our kind of democracy. Remember what the founding father of America said, that the republic for the United States will only work for a religious and God-fearing, Bible-reading population. It's wholly inadequate for any other. And so when America abandoned Christianity and started to flood the country with immigrants from other parts of the world and other religions even, then that system was doomed because you cannot expect a Republican-type democracy, a laws-based society, to flourish if you've got people who don't have that upbringing in the scriptures, who do not have a Christian ethos. And so bringing in people who believe in religious freedom should only be for our religion, not for others, and who believe in beheading, chopping of hands and feet and things like this, then, well, it's not going to work, is it? Well, Bashar al-Assad had a constitution adopted in 2012 that guaranteed freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and women's rights. And however imperfect, they were at least still protecting Christians and there was religious freedom. Now, when most people think of Assad's government and why it had to be toppled, most people come out with chemical and gas attacks. Now, in the world today, you can incinerate people with phosphorus bombs, you can napalm them, you can bomb them to shreds, you can shoot them, you can do all sorts of things, but whatever you do, you don't use chemical or biological weapons, you don't use gas. I mean, that is string for Borton on the Kenum Sandahiri, you cannot even think about it. That is like the one last war crime left in the world. And so every time Assad's army were winning and they were totally turning the tide and ISIS were on the retreat, there would be suddenly some kind of gas attack story. And it wouldn't make sense. The first ones in 2012, near Aleppo and near Hama and Damascus, there were a whole bunch of chemical attacks. And these attacks were proven later to be false flags, staged. Irrefutable evidence was produced, disproving the allegations that Assad's regime used gas. Why would the winning army use gas? I mean, the one thing that could bring the wrath of the world upon them, why would they do that? It was obviously fabricated, and these were false flags. The reports I've seen, the 2012 and the 2018 gas attacks, where people were killed or wounded by gas attacks, chlorine gas, mustard gas, sarin gas. These were the claims. The reports I've seen is that the one set of attacks were actually false flags organized by Turkey, and that the others were organized by Saudi Arabia. And plainly, these were designed to be false flags that were fabricated, staged attacks in order to discredit the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and bring in Western bombing and attacks and cruise missiles coming in, destroying the Syrian Air Force and things like that. So these chemical weapon attacks were false flags, were false accusations. They were plainly staged in order to discredit the present the government that was there then. So now Syria is under rule of an al-Qaeda warlord, and the country's predictably descended into mass killings, terror, revenge massacres, targeting religious minorities. So Jilani's, or now we've got to call them al-Shara's forces, have solidified control, and they've quietly launched combing operations to find and exterminate leaders of the Alawites, Christians, and other religious minorities. And Alawite defenders, led by some of the previous Tiger forces of Syria, have attempted to resist, but they've been badly outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and the death toll very quickly surpassed 1,000, and it's rising rapidly. Defenseless men, women, children, entire families slaughtered in cold blood. In many cases, the killers were filming themselves with body cams or their own cell phones as they shouted Allahu Akbar and shot people in the head in cold blood. And well, some of the videos we're seeing have been faded out so that you don't see the actual hideous mutilations. You can tell exactly what's going on. It's grotesque. They're literally cutting people's throats and cold blood and things like that. So fearing mass execution, 9,000 civilians amongst the Alawites have fled to the Russian military base at Hyman, which admitted them. And so I would have found it hard to believe that people would be fleeing to Russian bases for sanctuary. The first half of my life, Russia was the enemy. We were fighting in Rhodesia, Southwest Africa, South Africa. They were leading the terrorists who were attacking us in Southwest Africa, Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia. So it's kind of strange for me to think of the people who were my enemy for the first half of my life are now providing sanctuary for Christians who need a place to flee to. But Russia still has an air base in the north of the country at Latika, and they've got a naval base at Tartus, which is more towards the south on the coast of the Mediterranean. And that's where some are fleeing. There's also a whole lot of others who are fleeing to Lebanon. And U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio issued a statement. And let's be fair, you can't blame the present administration for what Barack Hussein Obama and Biden did. They are against it. So here's the statement from the present U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The United States condemns the radical Islamicist terrorists, including the foreign jihadis that murdered people in Western Syria in recent days. The United States stands with Syria's religious and ethnic minorities, including its Christian, Druze, Alawite, and Kurdish communities, and offers its condolences to the victims and their families. Now, that's good, and it's good to get an acknowledgement that there were a lot of foreign jihadis. In fact, my information is there were 20,000 foreign nationals fighting in the so-called civil war. I wouldn't call it a civil war when so many of the enemy causing the problems come from Pakistan, India, Saudi Arabia, from Canada, the United States, Great Britain. They came from all over. Radical Islamic jihadists paid for by the USAID and CIA, who were under this ISIS movement. And by the way, Biden at one stage when vice president under Obama had to admit to Congress, yes, we did start ISIS, but it's in a good cause. They are fighting against Assad's regime in Syria, who, as you know, have done gas attacks. And yes, they've gotten out of control. I would say they've got out of control. They started beheading Christians in Libya and doing all sorts of hideous things. But, you know, it's for a good cause, because look at the big picture. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, as proven with Afghanistan and supporting al-Qaeda, your enemy of today can change, and your friend of today could become your enemy. And so bear in mind that even those al-Qaeda jihadis being supported in Afghanistan later got involved in anti-American terrorist attacks. So you've got to be careful what you invest in. And this has happened so many times. Just remember what Jonas Savimbi said. If you make a mistake, you're human, we all make mistakes. But if you make the same mistake twice, you're stupid. If you make the same mistake 15 times, you've got a hidden agenda. Now, USAID has toppled 8 governments, and Syria just being the most recent. And that wasn't accidental. Those were deliberate. From Ukraine through to Syria, these are targeted regime change operations, which really need to stop. So you've got such devastation caused. We've got more than 6 million refugees have been displaced from Syria because of the war. And they are part of the great human tidal wave, this tsunami of migrants who fled into Europe. There's over 1 million in Germany. I've met Syrian refugees as far away as Belgium, spoken to them about what led them to flee and so on. And we need to understand the internal devastation is also huge. Syria used to be a very prosperous country with a high standard of living. Today, 90% of the population are said to be living in poverty, 80% are facing food insecurity, which means starvation. And this is something that was funded by the US taxpayer without their knowledge or approval, of course, but USAID put $15 billion into regime change in Syria over the last 10 years. Who knows how much has been put in by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and Israel? But we know they've also been supporting ISIS. They've all wanted to get rid of Assad's government. And I'm not too sure why. There's many worse governments in the world. And when you are fighting against radical terrorists, it's hard to resist violent people, behead people, and so on, without using some force. So this continual demonizing of the Syrian government because they used force to defend themselves against bloodthirsty terrorists. I found the Greek prime minister's comments interesting. Antonis Samaras, the prime minister of Greece, said that what is happening in Syria is neo-Ottoman Turkish inspired. It is being implemented by terrorists of Ahmed al-Sharaa, who did not change just because he now started to wear a tie. Replacing an authoritarian leader with a leading member of al-Qaeda inevitably leads to massacres of thousands of civilians, and the scenes of barbarism humanity cannot bear. And it's true, even TV stations that have no problem showing hideous pictures are blanking out large sections of the massacres because it's just too hideous for us to even want to see. And so the Greek prime ministers urged the European Union to condemn the massacres and to reinstate sanctions against the al-Sharaa regime, which I don't think is likely to happen because the EU supported this ISIS terrorist in taking power. And despite his official denials, the evidence suggests that the HTS leader, al-Jalani, now al-Sharaa, actually ordered his fighters to stop filming their atrocities to avoid further international backlash. You know, it's very hard to say we peaceful and moderate while your own supporters are broadcasting on social media pictures of you killing defenseless civilians and religious minorities. So Western media long portrayed Assad as a brutal dictator. But the scale of violence under al-Jalani's rule has exceeded even the worst predictions. I expected a crackdown. I didn't expect it to be this violent either. The mass extermination of Alawites and Christians is unfolding as a stark reminder of what happens when radical jihadists are handed power under the guise of democracy. And this has happened before. I mean, just think of Iran as the Shah's Iran, which was moderate, peaceful, stable, a Western ally, was betrayed by Jimmy Carter's government into the hands of the Ayatollah Khomeini and his real crazy radicals. Now, the Western powers condemned President Assad for being overly harsh with the Islamic terrorists invading Syria. But these events demonstrate no leader, no matter how kind or enlightened that leaders, can possibly have suppressed such horrors without force. We need to face that reality. You cannot fight violent people without some violence. And when a bad person with a gun can then be opposed by a good person with a gun, for example. And the Biden administration has worked to topple President Assad. And once they did that, there was no one left to defend these Syrians. I know there were a lot of Christians in the Syrian army. And the reason is there was nothing else standing between them and being beheaded by ISIS and then the secular government of Assad who were protecting them. So now the Christians are dwindling under systematic extermination. Syria is being redrawn under the domination of one of the world's most dangerous terrorists, one who used to have $10 million bounty on his head. The question is, will Syria emerge now as the new Islamic Caliphate, as it once did centuries before? Will the world act before it's too late? Unlikely, because the Western world has a track record of betrayal. And Ian Smith wrote the book, The Great Betrayal, and he said so wisely, "We in Rhodesia were never beaten by our enemies. We were betrayed by our friends." And the Shah of Iran's book, The Shah's Story, that also tells the story of how the worst thing he ever did was trust America and listen to Jimmy Carter and allow American General Haig to basically restrain his armed forces from doing what needed to be done to stop this uprising of the Ayatollah Khomeini's crazies, and basically left his regime completely undefended and vulnerable. Others have written books called The Great Betrayal, How America Abandoned the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. And the Kurds have been betrayed horribly, starting with Winston Churchill, redrawing the map. And then you can think of the books like Victims of Yalta, written by Nikolai Tolstoy, on the hideous betrayal, the secret betrayal that the Allies betrayed the Christians of Eastern Europe, particularly the Russians and Ukrainians. 2 million Russians, 1 million Ukrainians, even those who'd never even lived in Russia or Ukraine, who'd been born in the West, their families had fled the Bolshevik Revolution. 3 million East Europeans were forcibly rounded up by the soldiers of Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, forced across the border into the hands of the NKVD. And that's the infamous Operation Keelhaul, which was sealed for 30 years. The stories only started really to come out in 1975. But the hideous betrayal of millions of Christians into the hands of the bloodthirsty, mass-murdering Joseph Stalin, that is something that will live in infamy forever. And we learn all kinds of things from Operation World, for example. My good friend Patrick Johnson, who's been the founder of the Operation World Defensive Prayer Guide to Every Nation, that massive book, it documents how there were 15 million Christians in the Middle East in 2010. So before the Arab Spring, 15 million Christians in the Middle East, most of those in Egypt, Iraq, and Syria, by the way. And because of the Arab Spring, which was Western-sponsored, we lost 5 million Christians from the Middle East. The Middle East is the only part of the world which has less Christians now than it used to have, and which continues to bleed Christians. It's getting less and less. It's becoming less evangelized. You cannot replace 5 million Christians whose families were in the Middle East for generations, for centuries, for over a millennium in many cases. Doesn't matter how many missionaries you throw into the Middle East, it's not going to make up for 5 million Christians who were embedded in there for generations. And so the Operation Timber Sycamore and the so-called Arab Spring have brought down the number of Christians in the Middle East from 10 million to from 15 million to 10 million. That's 5 million less. That's absolutely hideous. In 2010, I was part of the largest missions conference in history, the Cape Town 2010, also known as Lausanne 3, and there were 4,200 people who participated in the Cape Town 2010 missions conference. And at that point, we learned how bad it was in the Middle East. There were only 15 million Christians in the Middle East. Well, now, after the Arab Spring, the numbers have gone down to 10 million. So this is the end result of Barack Hussein Obama's policies and Biden's policies. We are seeing a great increase in the persecution of Christians, and we're seeing a great decrease in the number of Christians in the Middle East. And this fall of Syria is catastrophic from a Christian perspective. Syria is one of the heartlands, one of the birthplace of Christianity. Antioch is where we were first called Christians, according to the Book of Acts. And so here we are seeing an ancient country with a great civilization, which has still Christians dating back for over a millennium, some maybe to over two millenniums. And they're being targeted for extermination right now, thanks to treacherous, backstabbing Western politicians. And we've got to learn the lesson. This is not accidental. This has got to be deliberate. Nobody can be this stupid to make these mistakes again and again and again. How many times must we see this pattern? Stable governments that fight terrorism being betrayed by the West, and then a bunch of mass murdering thugs with a communist Ornish case, radical Islamicist jihadist take power with Western aid, and then people started to get murdered for no other reason than they're the wrong religion, the wrong minority, the wrong tribe and race and so on. So this, I think, needs to wake people up. There was so much great rejoicing and celebrations, especially in the Western capitals, when President Assad's government was overthrown. And we were assured peace had come to Syria. And there were all kinds of public assurances. The new administration would respect religious minorities and freedoms and women's rights. And the so-called interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, reacted to these reports now of blaming the victims of threatening his government. I mean, this is typical. The people who lying in a ditch, who've been shot in the head, have been shot in the back, these disarmed, unarmed people whose hands are tied behind their backs, they're the ones to blame. And the poor guys who've been doing the mass murders, they're the victims in this case. I mean, how many times must we hear this kind of rhetoric and garbage? And the liberals, who the so-called progressives and so on, the ones that campaigned for the fall of South Vietnam. And when South Vietnam fell and North Vietnam started to massacre people in South Vietnam and massacre people in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge killed a third of the population of Cambodia and the massacres in Laos, they suddenly lost interest in Southeast Asia. They were protesting, you know, hell no, we won't go and make love, not war. And, you know, they were completely against any attempt to defend these countries from communism. But when communism took over, suddenly they weren't interested in what happened thereafter. It's like off the table. Same thing with South Africa. They campaigned and campaigned against this evil, racist, apartheid government in South Africa, the National Party government, who were fighting against communists. And they were hurting some. They were locking up some. They were shooting others. And, well, you know, we were under attack. It was the Cold War, very hot part of the Cold War in Southern Africa. And we were facing Soviet MiGs and tanks on our borders and car bombs and limpet mines and missiles inside our countries, shooting down civilian airliners, cooking and eating the survivors, murdering people, babies and cots being killed, whole missionary families being killed, whole congregation being herded into churches and burned down around them. And yet Britain and America continued to sanction Rhodesia, sanction South Africa, do everything they could to boycott and attack us, doing everything they could to aid the terrorists, even giving information that would enable these Marxist terrorists to seize power, aiding them with funds, weapons even. And then at the end, when these Marxists take over and they start to massacre the Matabele, like in Zimbabwe, hurtling the minority tribe down mine shafts like Attica Mine and Antelope Mine in Matabele land, and the killing fields of Zimbabwe, what we called the long fields in many ways, that somehow didn't make the news because that wasn't relevant. Because according to the narrative, the good guys had won, the evil, horrible racists were out, and now we had these enlightened moderates in power, even if there were mass murdering thugs and Marxists like Robert Mugabe, who said to the farmers, "You have degrees in agriculture. We have degrees in violence. I was trained in Red China." And well, he didn't use the word red. "I was trained in China." And he has actually got a picture of himself wearing those Chinese pajamas in a graduating class of terrorists in China. And Robert Mugabe, ZANU-PF, looted, bludgeoned, mass murdered, massacred the people of Zimbabwe and wiped out herds of elephants with helicopter gunships and fighter jets to get enough ivory to ship to their friends in China and Vietnam. So these are the results that come from Western betrayal. We were never beaten by our enemies. We were betrayed by our friends. We fought alongside Britain in the First World War, the Second World War, the Malayan conflict, in the case of South Africa, also in the Korean conflict. And we were stabbed in the back by our erstwhile allies. My father fought in the 8th Army in North Africa under Field Marshal Montgomery much of the time, and in Italy, 6 years, all 6 years of the war, serving in the Royal Artillery. And at the end, the thanks is to have our country betrayed by the very people that we fought for. Absolutely staggering. So we need to recognize this is the fruit of the Arab Spring. This is the fruit of USAID. This is the fruit of Barack Hussein Obama. And the British government still thinks now it's good to give millions of pounds to these mass murdering thugs. And I just wonder, when are people going to learn we should realize by now, we have got extremely treacherous people in our governments. And the scripture says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers. What fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? What part is a believer with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? You are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them, I will walk amongst them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. That's in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. We really need to recognize that USAID and the British Foreign Office has been abused to undermine Christian churches and freedom around the world, and they have increased persecution of the church worldwide. So woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. That's in Isaiah 5 verse 20. Billions and billions of dollars and pounds have been given to mass murdering thugs who behead and crucify Christians, who shoot civilians, and have done all kinds of imaginative tortures against these people. And right now, I think Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Turkey all need to be exposed, along with the State of Israel, for having funded and supported ISIS terrorists who now have taken control of Syria. So there are some memes that are out there with ISIS made in the USA. And sadly, that is true. This is part of a CIA-backed operation, and also Mossad, it needs to be said too. Bear in mind that even Hamas is the end result of a Mossad operation, because some geniuses worked out an idea years ago that to defeat the PLO, how about if we support a revival of Islamic Quranic-based opposition, because the Palestinian Liberation Organization was a terrorist organization, mostly secular, mostly Marxist, very much controlled by the KGB in Moscow. And so Mossad conceived the idea of funding and encouraging a revival of Islamic-based study groups, out of which grew the Muslim Brotherhood, and out of that grew Hamas and Hezbollah. And so even today, you can see what Professor Anthony Sutton said about the U.S. Wall Street bankrolling the Bolshevik Revolution. You could also say about the present-day terrorists we're facing, in many cases, they've been created by their apparent enemies for whatever reason in their minds. But to think that the CIA and Mossad helped to produce ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who today are a real existential threat to them. So this is a warning to stop playing Dr. Frankenstein. You won't like what the results are that comes out of it. And we've got bombing of churches in Egypt, massacres of Christians, people in the streets behead those who insult Islam, freedom go to hell, and be prepared for the real Holocaust. These are sort of things these militants are holding up signs in the street. So along with the Arab Spring has come a tidal wave of fanaticism on the streets and a sharp increase in violent persecution of Christian communities. And just think of how many Christians, how many hundreds, how many thousands of Christian victims have suffered as a result of these disgusting political games played by the State Department, USAID, and these other characters. What were they thinking? And what on earth does anyone think is going to happen now? As Syria, a stable, prosperous, productive country, has been destabilized, betrayed, handed over to a bunch of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, mass murdering terrorist thugs. So nobody should be surprised at what's going on right now there. And it's got to stop. We've got to stop this deep state causing of havoc around the world, betraying of stable governments, and betraying people in the hands of mass murdering thugs and terrorists. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
And can you just let the audience know where they can find your work? Also, there's a Give, Send, Go button, I believe, included in the post for this show. So please avail yourself of that, and how they can contact you, Peter.
Yes, thank you very much. I've written the book Slavery, Terrorism and Islam, The Historical Roots and Contemporary Threat, which has been a very much a best-selling type book. And we've gone through three editions, each edition double the size of the previous one. The third edition is now three times the size of the original edition. and it got me death threat fatwas for producing it, been very much in demand. And the Slavery Terrorism Islam is now available as an ebook, as a print on demand, or hard copy. And people can go onto our website, www.frontlinemissionsa, that's SA short for South Africa, frontlinemissionsa.org. And you will see we've also got books pre-positioned in North America, so people can order over there without the delays and extra expense of shipping across the Atlantic. We actually had the book so much in demand, we printed a whole lot of Slavery, Terrorism, Islams in the United States to save on transportation costs. And you'll see a lot of audiovisual and other things and projects like Gifts and Go projects of trying to bring the gospel to our enemies. I believe that there's no political solution or military solution to the chaos and wars in the Middle East. I believe the only real long-term solution is a spiritual solution. We need to fulfill the Great Commission. We need to evangelize enemies. We need to bring Muslims to the Messiah. We need to design gospels for guerrillas, tracts for terrorists. And that's what I've been doing for the last 42 years, working in restricted access areas. And I've managed to show the Jesus film in different languages, including Arabic, in terrorist bases behind the lines in the Middle East. I've been able to get into communist terrorist bases and show them Christian films, hand out gospel literature. We've led radicals to Christ. We've led terrorists to Christ. We've led Muslim jihadists and Marxist terrorists to Christ. I've got quite a number of testimonies of from communism to Christ and people who've Muslims who found the Messiah. And so our mission, Frontline Fellowship, is dedicated to evangelizing in war zones, helping persecuted churches work in restricted access areas. We've got a lot of research from that, and we can help others who are interested in how their church can be involved in making an impact for good. I believe the solution is not bombing the people, but rather taking Bibles instead of sending in the Marines, send in the missionaries. And I think ultimately being more than a conqueror. David killed Goliath. That made him a conqueror. But Jesus is more than a conqueror. He took Saul of Tarsus, the persecutor of the church, on the road to Damascus and turned him into Paul the apostle, the evangelist and missionary of the church. And I have won some terrorists to Christ who were trained in Patrice Lumumba University, who went from communism to Christianity and helped us. And, you know, instead of just eradicating your enemy, it's sometimes very strategic to win some enemies over to help you fight against more enemy, winning more of them over. And so we've got large numbers of ex-communists and ex-Muslims who are now working to advance the gospel. And I believe that's the most strategic. So, yes, if people want to contact us, my personal email is peter@frontline.org.za. peter@frontline.org.za. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, so we'll play the closing music. I want to thank all of you for joining us today for a presentation entitled The Real Story Behind the Massacres in Syria. Peter and I'll be back with you again next Tuesday. And until then, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye for now.